Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the end of the Bush era following the withdrawal of Jeb Bush from the Republican presidential race, as one political dynasty appears to have outlived its welcome with the American people, while another political dynasty, the Clintons, picks up steam with a win in the Nevada caucuses ahead of next Saturday's South Carolina primary, which Hillary Clinton is favored to win. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, a former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell, joins us to discuss the irony that the leading Republican presidential candidate, Donald Trump, who is coming off a big win in South Carolina, is the only politician telling the truth about the fact that Jeb Bush's brother did not keep us safe from 9/11, lied us into a disastrous war in Iraq that has destabilized the Middle East and almost tanked the economy. We will look into another outburst of truth-telling from Donald Trump in his victory speech in South Carolina, a state with a large military vote, in which Trump announced he will make sure our military gets the weapons that the troops want, not what the lobbyists and defense contractors foist on us. Pierre Spray, a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer who was the primary designer of the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack warplane, joins us to discuss the latest failures of the world's most expensive weapon system, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, that is the epitome of the waste and fraud boondoggle that Trump is pointing to. Then finally, an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years, Frederick Clarkson, joins us to discuss the paradox that South Carolina's evangelicals, who make up 65% of the Republican vote, voted overwhelmingly for a thrice-divorced, expletive-prone casino owner over an openly theocratic candidate, Ted Cruz, who frequently makes the claim that religious freedom is under assault in the United States as he campaigns under the dominionist banner of Christian rightists who believe they have a biblical mandate to control all earthly institutions. And joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. He currently teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And what do you make of this extraordinary staying power? It's not just the rise of Donald Trump, it's the staying power of Donald Trump that clearly has the Republican establishment nervous. They seem to be throwing their weight behind this callow neoconservative opportunist, Marco Rubio. But at this point, he can't keep celebrating second and third places as though he's won, while the other guy is just winning by huge margins.
No, I think you're right, and I'm tempted to conduct the following analysis succinctly. The Republican Party's reaping the whirlwind it began with the Nixon strategy many years ago. It has constantly caused itself to have to dip into its rabid, racist, ignorant base in order to survive a primary process and even keep it aboard in order to win in a general election. And suddenly now it is looking not at the Tea Party aspect of that base, which it feared and thought was going to do this, but at a portion of that base which, as you said, is led by someone whom they should abhor, a billionaire, one of those people who's participated in their disenfranchisement, their disempowerment, and everything else that has happened to them over the last few years that they hate. He is now leading the pack, and that is an irony of the first order, and as I said, I think it's what the Republican Party inevitably was going to reap if it kept on its path towards its minority.
So when pundits talk about how the Republican establishment is going to get behind Rubio, what is left of the Republican establishment? Surely George W. Bush, the former president, doesn't have a lot of traction, particularly now that his brother's dropped out.
I think you're seeing the end of the Papa Barbara dynasty. Yeah, frankly, you're seeing the end of the Bush dynasty. It was a little bit, I didn't have a tear in my eye, but I did feel a little bit of a pang of conscience for old Jeb, because old Jeb was the better one of them all, sans the dad. I think the dad was the best of them all, but of the youngsters, Jeb was the best, and George beat him out. George was probably the worst. Who made that decision? I don't know. I've been told it was Barbara, but that was a bad decision in the Bush dynasty. I think they're finished. I think we've seen that moderate Republicans, which H.W. Bush represented, and I think Jeb did too in the final analysis. George was an aberration, and we could talk about that forever. But I think that signals the end of moderation in the Republican Party, and you're seeing what it means to replace it.
But to some extent, Colonel Wilkinson, you can't blame the American people for feeling disgusted with politicians, disgusted with gridlock and paralysis in Washington. And when Trump says all politicians do is spew hot air, make pronouncements, give speeches, and basically never deliver on anything they promise, meanwhile, he gets things done, he builds things, you know, so I could, to some extent, I understand why people are on the left are flocking to Bernie Sanders, and on the right, they're flocking to Donald Trump.
I think it's understandable. As you said, in both cases, I think people see Hillary as an unprincipled Democrat plugged into many of the same parts of Wall Street and elsewhere in the great big oligarchy we've become as the Republicans are. And Bernie is someone who's contesting that and standing more for traditional progressive liberal values that the Democratic Party came to represent. And as I said, on the other hand, Trump standing there representing this rabid right wing of the Republican Party, from evangelicals to the actual nuts in the party, the racists in the party, is a contradiction of terms. But you put your finger on, I think, why he appeals to them. They do not like what's happening to their country, and when I say what's happening to their country, gay rights, other rights belonging to minorities, too many immigrants, the church being, in their estimation, stepped on by secularism. We could go on and on. They see that as anathema, and Donald Trump has sensed that. He's not a dumb man. He's a smart man. He's sensed that. And he's not for it or against it. He's just opportunistically exploiting what it is that they want, and he may ride that right to the Republican Party nomination. And I say more power to him, because it'll be a Goldwater general election. He'll be murdered in the general election. And if he isn't, then I think all sane and sober people ought to contemplate leaving the country.
In other words, we'll all be murdered.
Yeah. He can't be elected. I mean, that's the only thing that comforts me. I'm going to watch this with some interest in what my party does afterwards in order to pick itself up and continue to be a viable political party. I do think we need two viable political parties. And right now, the Republican Party is committing suicide.
And again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is a former chief of staff to United States Secretary Colin Powell, and he currently teaches courses at the College of William and Mary and George Washington University. But it seems to me there's some doubt as to whether how serious Trump is in general. My sense is that he doesn't want to be president so much as he wants to win the presidency. And I recall that famous dinner, the press dinner, at which President Obama made fun of Donald Trump, and he looked furious. He made jokes about Donald Trump's TV show where he fires people, and Obama said, you know, those kind of decisions keep me up at night. And of course, we all know in retrospect that Obama had just, they just executed the killing of Osama bin Laden. And it was pretty clear that Trump was completely humiliated by that event. And I'm wondering whether that's a factor here, because it just seems to me that there's something that's not serious about this whole performance that's going on. Maybe it's because he's a performer.
I think you put your finger on it. I could say that I think he's more clever by half than any of us believe, and that what he's done is exactly what I just described to you. He set out to destroy the Republican Party. And he's done a very, very effective job of that, and will continue to do that as far as I'm concerned. And if he's the nominee, he will put a fait accompli to it. It'll be done. You might as well put a fork in the Republican Party. It will have to completely resurrect itself with new leadership, new platform, new program, a bigger tent into which it brings minorities and others, change its basic policies, even look for different Supreme Court justice, perhaps, than people like Scalia and others. It'll have to be an entirely different party if it wishes to become viable and successful again in the presidential race. Now, that said, the oligarchy has been really busy out there in the hinterland taking over state governments, from Scott Walker to, you name it, North Carolina. The Republicans have taken over the state legislatures, they've taken over the governorships, and they are destroying much of what's good about this country post-World War II, or even I could say post-Civil War, because one of the things they're going after is public universities. They're trying to destroy them. They're cutting their budget. They're making it untenable for them to exist. They want them to privatize and so forth and so on. So while I'm saying the Republican Party on the national level is suicidal, the Republican Party down in the states has been very successful, and I think to the detriment of the country.
But that's a very hard thing to understand, why the Koch brothers and other plutocrats would want Americans to be dumbed down and even more less educated than it is now. And, of course, the lack of education is drawing people to Trump's banner.
Absolutely. I don't see it as something that's not traditional for the plutocracy. The industrial elite, if you will. They do not want an educated public. You educate people, including Americans, at the university level to make them better citizens, despite what U.S. News and World Report and all the rest of these junk magazines report all the time about the purpose of a university. It is not to educate people for a job. That is not what universities do. They educate people to be better citizens. They teach them to think critically. They do not train them. They educate them. That is not what the industrial elite in this country wants. They do not want informed citizens. They do not want people who will go to the ballot box with a head and not being idiots. They do not want people who will contest their rule. They want to destroy the educational system in America, and they want robots, artificial intelligence, you name it, and workers who won't question anything, those that will work for $13 an hour, $8 an hour even, and not question a thing. People who don't understand that don't understand what the industrial elite has been doing in this country for 200 years. And for the most part, labor, organized labor in particular, and the government from time to time have put checks on that. But when the government and organized labor don't put checks on it, either because they can't or, like labor, they've been virtually destroyed, then predatory capitalism goes off the charts, and that's what we're having happen today. And predatory capitalists do not want informed citizens. So they do not like university education, except, of course, for their children.
So given that the oligarchs want us to be don't want us to be active citizens, but want us to be passive consumers.
Look at what they've done, Ian, across the country. Mm-hmm. You can get elected now, and this I put this at the feet of the American people. You can get elected now at the county, parish, township, governor level in this country with less than 10% of the eligible voters voting for you. And that's not unique. So, that's more or less average.
But I was going to ask that, or pose the question that if the plutocrats and the oligarchs don't want us to be active citizens but rather want us to be passive consumers, where is the purchasing power going to come to consume since they're taking
brilliant.
All the money?
That's a brilliant question. I keep talking to some of these people in the light of the old story of the goose that killed the golden egg, or the people that killed the goose that laid the golden eggs. I mean, how can you, for example, disbelieve climate change, disbelieve the need for sustainable operations from regenerative agriculture to better sources of energy, less polluting sources of energy? How can you discount that and think you're going to survive? Is it the fact that you're just going to take your millions and run off to Aruba or Trinidad and Tobago or someplace else and you don't give a damn about your children and your grandchildren and so forth and so on? But that's the basic attitude I encounter. No one's thinking about that word we never use anymore. Have you ever thought about how little we use the phrase our posterity anymore? You never hear it. No one thinks about that anymore. All they think about is the bottom line for themselves, their shareholders, those who are in it with them. That's all they think about. No one cares about the future. That's why you have such little action with regard to the biggest threat we all confront, planetary climate change. And that's why you have this kind of self-fulfilling, self-suicidal almost approach to capitalism. Read Thomas Piketty's book and see what we're doing to ourselves.
or read the Constitution, which uses the word posterity quite a lot. Just in the last few minutes, Colonel Wilkins, I want to get back to Trump's truth-telling, even though, as you say, he's probably going to take the Republican Party down with him. He is nevertheless saying stuff that our incurious press and our gutless Democrats have never really taken on, and that is taking on this canard that George W. Bush kept us safe in spite of 9/11, and that he pointed out again a few days ago that we went into Iraq based on lies, and Iraq has unraveled the Middle East, and the only country that won the Iraq War is Iran. And he also went after the military-industrial complex and Big Pharma. He's in effect going after the American empire.
He is, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm applauding when he's truth-telling, and I'm cringing when he's not backing what he says up with any kind of facts and when he's outright lying, because I know what he's doing. He's doing what politicians in all times have done, but he's doing it to the tune of a reality TV show. I mean, there is absolutely no one who seems willing to check up on him. Whether he's truth-telling or whether he's lying outright, it all seems very brilliantly, in my estimation, designed to opportunistically appeal to the people that you and I have just talked about. And these people don't care if he's violative of some of their Christian ethics, for example, because he's saying the things that are more powerfully resonating with them that they feel impact their lives more importantly, even perhaps than their dominionist Christianity. And so they're responding to him. That's clever. I would never call Donald Trump dumb. I would call him brilliant in the sense that he knows how to exploit this TV-addicted American audience to whom he's speaking.
But if he doesn't make it, the other person that the Republicans are likely to offer up is this sort of callow neocon opportunist, Marco Rubio. And there again, I get back to the criticism of our press, our incurious press, and the Democratic Party for allowing all of these disasters like Iraq, like 9/11, Iraq, and then the tanking of the economy to sort of go unquestioned. I mean, the British at least have had an inquiry into the Iraq war. There's been no such inquiry. The neocons have got off the hook entirely, and now the neocons are running Marco Rubio.
They're running Marco Rubio, and as far as I can tell, some of them are advising Hillary Clinton and even other candidates on the Republican side than Marco Rubio. So they aren't dead. They're still around, and they're not discredited. They're still wreaking their havoc, and I suspect they will continue to do so. I read a piece by Ken Pollack the other day that just blew my socks off, predicting that Tunisia's going, Turkey's going, everything in the Northern Africa, Southwest Asia area is going to go if we don't immediately do something really great militarily with regard to the Syrian conflict. I mean, this is the neoconservative line, and they're still out there. They're still speaking. They're still powerful. They're still influential. They're still advising. Again, the American citizens don't seem to, nor their media, call them to count when they should. There's not even, as you said, or as you indicated, there's not even a recounting of their crimes of the past. They just get a clean slate. Every TV show they're on, every article they write, every piece they put out into the general media, it's like they started at day one the minute that piece came out. There's no recounting of their history, which is disastrous.
Well, Colonel Wilkinson, let's stay in touch through this, the agony of this election year. And I guess in November we'll consult on which country we're going to migrate to.
You think I'm kidding.
No, I don't. I think you're serious. All righty. Well, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Good luck to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into another outburst of truth-telling from Donald Trump as he attacked the military-industrial complex.
Empire, the newborn of a hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. After he left the Pentagon, he went on to found Maple Shade Records. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pierre Spray.
Hey, great to talk to you, Ian.
And it's pretty extraordinary that Donald Trump is this, sort of the only politician in America who's a truth teller. Our incurious press have let us down and never had an historical accounting, as we just discussed with Colonel Wilkerson, about the Bush era and what it wrought. But the only person who's speaking up and telling the truth is Donald Trump. And in his acceptance speech in South Carolina on Saturday night, he went after the military-industrial complex and said that he's going to make sure that our troops get the weapons they want, not the weapons that the contractors and their lobbyists foist on us. And he went on to say the drug companies control the drug industry. I mean, it's ridiculous. And the military companies, I mean, it's ridiculous. Obviously, no specifics, but at least he's talking about it.
Absolutely. No, and the only other thing that's as extraordinary that as a candidate who's actually attacking endless war and the empire, the only other thing that's as extraordinary is the extraordinary media blackout on what he's saying. You can hardly find a major TV channel or a major newspaper that says boo about the fact that he thinks we're crazy to be destroying all these countries in the Middle East.
And in terms of the work that you've been doing to alert the – and by the way, when you talk about the Middle East, I must say it's pretty amazing to see that Obama, who's getting heavily criticized for, in Syria and Iraq for leading from behind as he's charged, the only intervention that the U.S. has done – pretty much is now that they have the use of the NATO air base in Incirlik, Turkey, they're deploying your airplane, the A-10, the very airplane that the military-industrial complex wants to cancel.
Absolutely. And the Air Force has never given up on the dream of canceling that.
Right. And also, by the way, they are deploying the A-10 in Lithuania to counter a possibility of Putin moving on the Baltic states, as he has done on Ukraine. So here again, the plane that's, what, decades old is the only one that's doing any real heavy lifting. And meanwhile, all of our treasure is being poured in to this amazingly useless Turkey, the F-35, that you and another group of experts had a press conference on recently in Washington. So walk us through the latest abomination vis-a-vis the F-35.
There's been a really amazing test report produced by the director of operational test and evaluation in the Pentagon, essentially the only senior official in the Pentagon who tells any truth about weapons that are failing. And he has put out a really gutsy report. He's required by law, by congressional law that our military reform caucus helped to pass back in the 80s. He's required to report every year in unclassified form on the state of every major procurement and the state of its testing. And fortunately, he reports only to the Secretary of Defense and to the Congress. He put out in this year's report an amazing 44 pages on the F-35. And every page has a scandal and a disgrace on it about the incompetence of the design, the horrible ineffectiveness of the airplane, another characteristic that it's been tested and failed. I mean, just amazing. The litany is endless, but I'll just run down a few of the highlights. You know, the airplane was supposed to be a terrific air-to-air fighter, a great bomber, and a close air support airplane. Of course, it fails miserably at all three of those tasks, as this report abundantly shows. But just as one example, this thing is so complicated and so unreliable that they're actually discovering more failure modes and more failures to meet specifications than the actual number of tests that they fly. Every time they fly a test, they discover, you know, new failures. The airplane is so complex and unreliable that it can barely manage to fly two times a week. That means, in essence, that it'll hardly ever be over enemy skies. Even worse, it means that we can't train our pilots. You know, because obviously the pilots are vastly more important than any piece of technology. And in general, in the wars where we've succeeded in the air, it's been because our pilots were better than the other side. This airplane is hopeless to train a decent pilot because you can't get enough hours out of it. To train a decent pilot, he needs to fly 30 or 40 times a month. This airplane, at present, in operational units, is letting pilots fly once every 5 days. I mean, imagine that. They can barely get more than a flight a week. And we expect them to go to combat and to be super skillful and better than the enemy? Hopeless. A real betrayal of the troops, since we're talking about troops versus the industrial complex. The airplane went up against an ancient F-16, a truly handicapped F-16. It was flying with 3,000 pounds of wing tanks. It was an ancient and the most sluggish model of F-16 they could find, a two-seater. And they flew 17 dogfights against the F-35. And the F-35 never once was able to either defend itself or to get a shot at the enemy. So all 17 dogfights, it got whipped by this ancient and almost crippled F-16.
My God. Let me just remind the audience again that I'm speaking with Pierre Spray, who's a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer. He's the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. So, but let's just begin. You can read some more of it, but I wanted to at least put the context out there for our listeners that we are talking about the F-35. It is the most expensive weapons system in the history of man. And I don't know what the latest figure is, but it's like the Iraq War. You dig a big hole in the desert and you just pour trillions of dollars in.
The latest official figure is $1.5 trillion over the life of the airplane. That's grossly understated. It could easily, if we want as many as they want to, they want to buy 2,500, it could easily be double that. But there's an interesting thing about the F-35, which bears on Trump's, you know, kind of nice statement that he wants to give the troops what they want and need versus what the lobbyists and the congressmen state, you know, want them want to buy.
Right.
And that's exactly this close support issue. That's a wonderful poster child for exactly what's going on. Close support is, beyond the shadow of a doubt, the single most important air-to-ground mission. It's the reason to have powerful air forces. The single most important thing you can do with powerful air forces is support the troops. That is, support them when they're directly engaged with the enemy. That's what close support is. That's a mission that the Air Force has hated forever because they love to be independent. They want to, the generals want to pick their own targets, you know, all that. The troops are screaming for close support in Afghanistan, and we're screaming in Iraq, and we're getting hopelessly inadequate airplanes and tiny numbers of A-10s. The Air Force headquarters was trying to hold back as many A-10s as possible so they wouldn't, you know, so they wouldn't look good. We actually only had a half squadron in Afghanistan for the entire duration of that war. And we had all these B-1s and F-15s fast jets that were hopeless at the mission. They kept on bombing funeral parties and wedding parties and all this. And all we could cough up for the troops was 12 A-10s. That was deliberate. That's because the generals hate it. And they hate it for the same reason that the contractors do. You've got to remember, when you're talking about the troops versus the lobbyists, you've got to include the generals with the lobbyists.
Right, but what you have to do, though, Pierre, is you have to also recognize that in what you're telling us is that these generals and these contractors don't care about our troops, and they'd rather see our troops die for lack of support then give them the support that's sitting there, you know, cooling its heels on airfields in the United States.
Exactly. And the reason is that to do close support right, you have to have a very simple airplane, very simple, very effective, carefully designed for that mission and no other. That's exactly what the military-industrial complex and the generals hate. It's too cheap. And if you make it expensive, it no longer works for close support. Mm-hmm. Just like this F-35, that's the most expensive airplane we've ever tried to build for close support, and it's worse than anything we've ever built, you know, that even claims to do the mission. So you have exactly that, that the generals are walking away from the troops in a very real sense, you know, betraying the troops. And by the way, this is not an Air Force-only problem. The Army is doing exactly the same thing to their troops because they're insisting on buying nothing but helicopters, because they had a treaty with the Air Force generals that they would buy helicopters and the Air Force generals would be in charge of buying fixed-wing aircraft. That treaty goes way back. It was a bureaucratic disaster for the troops. It still holds, and so Army generals, because they want to retire and go to work for helicopter manufacturers, are just as committed to hopelessly ineffective helicopters as Air Force generals are committed to hopelessly ineffective close support airplane, that is, to airplanes that don't do close support. The Navy's in the same boat, the Navy and the Marines. The Marines have been the single service that has pushed hardest for the F-35. And they, in fact, they're the ones who ruined the F-35 for the other services. Remember, this is a tri-service airplane, and the Marines demanded that the airplane be able to take off vertically. That's a militarily completely useless thing to do, because the thing can only fly vertically off a beautifully prepared concrete circle, and those don't exist in the jungles and the deserts where we fight.
Right. I'll give you a little local example of that. The Osprey, the plane they have that with the rotors that rotate. They landed them at Santa Monica Airport with the president one time with Obama, and they kick up so much dust and dirt and pebbles that they destroyed all the light aircraft at Santa Monica Airport. So you can't land those things anywhere except on a pristine concrete right. lily pad. You know,
exactly correct. So the Marines, you know, again, because the Marine Air Generals, you know, this is not not apply to the ground generals. The Marine Air Generals are now looking for cushy jobs in industry. So they keep on insisting on getting super expensive airplanes that do unique things like vertical takeoff that you don't need vertical takeoff and landing. And that means that the Marines are left high, the Marine troops are left high and dry with no close support. So the Army is betraying their troops with unbelievably clumsy and vulnerable helicopters that can't do close support. The Marines are betraying their troops by pushing for this F-35 kludge and incidentally ruining it for everybody else because they forced the airplane to be so fat to take in the lift fan engine that does the lifting for vertical takeoff and landing. So the Air Force and the Navy are stuck with the same, with the flight line mechanics call the guppy because it's so fat, or sometimes they call it the pregnant guppy. Which is a serious source of the unmaneuverability and inability to fight of this airplane. And the Navy, has since time immemorial totally ignored the close air support mission. The only thing they ever did for that mission was to throw the Marines some ancient airplanes the Navy couldn't use anymore. But they've never built their own airplane for close support to support their own Marines. So this is like a service-wide problem. To broaden what Trump talked about. In a way, it's the industry and the generals against the troops, and the troops come out the heavy loser. I mean, seriously heavy loser.
Well, when Trump said that the drug companies control the drug industry, I mean, it's ridiculous. And the military companies, I mean, it's ridiculous. There is an analogy from what you're telling us. The drug companies, for example, don't want to take on life-saving drugs that have gone out of patent, that have been around for hundreds of years. One of the latest anti-cancer drugs is based on cannabis, on marijuana, and they don't want to touch it because they're not making money out of it, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, it's the same thing with what you're telling us about the military-industrial complex. They don't want weapons that work for the troops. They want weapons that make money for them.
And here's a big stumbling block for Trump. The truth of the matter is that the more money you give either the drug companies or the military-industrial complex, the more they corrupt the system. And so Trump, when he's shooting off his mouth about how I'll spend whatever it takes to make us the greatest military in the world, he has no idea that if he doubles the military spending, he will totally wreck what the troops get, because it simply goes into the pockets of the contractors. They buy off the Congress to an even more
egregious degree, right? Yeah.
A greater degree than they are now.
Right.
They buy up even more generals, and the troops get left even hanging with even worse weapons.
Well,
more money is not at all the solution, in fact. More money is simply a road to getting even more complicated weapons that don't work, fewer of them, and we keep on flying ancient airplanes and sailing ancient warships in order to make up the gap, because the new stuff is so expensive nobody can afford it.
Well, P.S. Bray, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with P.S. Bray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. P.S. Bray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. And after he left the Pentagon, he went on to found Maple Shade Records. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years discussing the paradox that South Carolina's evangelicals voted overwhelmingly for a thrice-divorced, expletive-prone casino owner over an openly theocratic candidate, Ted Cruz.
you can't hide your lying eyes. And your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He has worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communication director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. His books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And he has a new report at politicalresearch.org, When Exemption is the Rule, The Religious Freedom Strategy of the Christian Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Clarkson.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be back with you.
And what are we to make of the results in South Carolina, which is a predominantly evangelical state? I believe up to 65% of the Republican voters who voted yesterday somewhat overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And then with Rubio coming in second by a hair, and then the evangelical candidate, if you will, or at least his father's a preacher, Ted Cruz, coming in third. What explains why the evangelicals voted for this thrice divorced, blasphemous fellow who's given to cursing and very unchristian dialogue, and even gets into a fight with the one of the great Christian leaders, the Pope Francis.
He's also a casino magnate.
Well, there you go. Even more evidence against him. So please explain that strange disconnect.
I think there are several paradoxes there. I mean, one is that the evangelicals, as a broad body, have never been uniform in their political views and have always gone for multiple candidates, and some are even Democrats. Let's not forget that Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and Al Gore are all evangelical Christians. So they've never been a voting bloc. They're a demographic bloc, but never been a voting bloc. But the paradox of voting for Donald Trump, who would seem to stand for everything that conservative Christians don't, and exit polling said that not only that, but that the people who tended to vote for him were people who identify as very conservative and for whom their religious identity is very important. So it's even more paradoxical. And so I've been giving that some thought, and I think that it probably has to do with two main things. One is that politicians have gotten good at appealing to evangelicals, and evangelicals are not stupid. They know when they're being pandered to, just like any other constituency. But the other thing is that it's the economic fears that often power conservative thinking, the fear of loss of jobs, particularly because he tends to appeal to a less well-educated white working class people. It's the otherization of immigrants, the fear of illegal and other kinds of immigrants coming in and affecting the economy, whether it's the welfare side or the economic side, and the fear of the immigrants themselves, their identities as potentially as Muslims and terrorists or as criminal gang members. Donald Trump has made a big point about the issue of opioid addictions, which is a big issue in the country. And the best efforts of the Bush and the Obama administrations to deal with the immigration issue, and the Congress for that matter, have failed. So people are looking for a, sort of a strong man, a man on a white horse kind of figure who is going to cut through the bull as they see it.
Well, clearly Trump's appeal has a lot to do with, I think, the general disgust in this country at our politics, at the polarization, at the gridlock in Washington, and in general at the fact that, as Trump reminds us very often, that politicians, all they do is talk and make empty promises, whereas he gets things done, he builds things. And I think that's Isn't that a big part of it, both on the Republican side and on the Democratic side with Bernie Sanders, who is a politician but is nevertheless out of the mold and in a similar way is speaking truth to power?
Yes, I think so. I think people are looking for a fresh approach, and that people are disgusted with the political establishments in both parties, and that they're dissatisfied with the job that's being done, the problems that don't get solved, and the way that they're treated. You'll notice on the Democratic side a lot of discussion about Hillary Clinton talking about "I" a great deal and not "we." And part of it was figured out that Bernie Sanders talks about "we" a lot, and so Hillary Clinton has changed her approach. But that's a bit of a political class otherization, too, where it's all about me and how I can manipulate you to vote for me so that I can advance my career and those of lobbyists and whatnot. And people feel like they're being had.
And again, I'm speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He has an article at a new report at politicalresearch.org, When Exemption is the Rule, the Religious Freedom Strategy of the Christian Right. I want to talk to you about that, but also about a recent article that you wrote as well, how one of the most extreme groups within the religious right is remaking the GOP race for the presidency. Dominionists are marching under Ted Cruz's banner. So let's talk a little bit about Ted Cruz, who came in third by a whisker in the sense that Rubio barely beat him. Rubio's a kind of his religious background is a little peculiar, because being born to a Cuban-American family as a Catholic, he then, when they moved to Las Vegas, the family became Mormons. And then when he got into a political career back in Florida, he switched back to being a Catholic again. It's probably not entirely a surprise that Mitt Romney's going to endorse him. Do you think there's a Mormon factor there?
There may be, although clearly as a former Mormon, that makes him an apostate. But I think it probably has less to do with his religious identity and more to do with the political establishment rallying around Rubio and saying he's going to be okay, and that he would be the choice for the establishment candidate, which was pretty interesting because there was some buzz in among the pundits not too long ago is that if the primaries go on long enough, it could become a brokered convention. And if so, if the only way to stop Trump was to have a brokered convention, they could turn to Mitt himself, even though he didn't run in the primaries as the savior of the party. But I think they're trying to head that off and try to move Rubio along. I will say, as far as religious identity goes on Rubio, is that he's not only Catholic. He publicly identifies Catholic, but he also makes a point of attending a local Baptist church, which is a bit of a trend among Republican politicians to have a religious identity, but also be acceptable to more than one religious identity within their constituency.
So just turning to Ted Cruz, who's by no means finished, and you, as I say, your article about the Dominionists marching under Ted Cruz's banner, since his father is a preacher, Ted Cruz's father, and a Dominionist, just one little political note. My understanding is that Cruz met recently with Dr. Ben Carson to urge him to get out of the race, and Carson apparently is still smarting from what Cruz did to him in Iowa, where he spread the word that falsely Carson was dropping out of the race, and then, of course, that cost Carson a lot of votes. So the meeting did not go well, I'm told. So as long as Carson stays in the race, he's draining votes from Cruz, is he not?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a fair question. If Carson dropped out, where would his votes go? And the assumption is that Cruz would get most of them, but But I think it's also fair to say that others would as well. Carson's voters are mostly evangelicals, but that doesn't necessarily mean that even if Carson can forgive, they'll choose Cruz.
And who do you think will pick up Jeb Bush's votes? Not that there are that many of them, but nevertheless, there's something there.
Well, that too is a mixed bag. I think that he'll mostly that his small votes are mostly establishment types. So they're going to be mixed among the Rubio and Kasich, I would guess. But I think that the Mitt Romney endorsement is probably a real indicator, a real bellwether of where establishment Republicans are supposed to go. John Kasich will make a brave effort in New England here on Super Tuesday. But, boy, you know, if the establishment really starts twisting arms to get behind Rubio, it would seem that they don't have a lot of time to make that happen.
So let's talk about the Dominionist factor in terms of Ted Cruz's banner. Is that significant, apart from the fact that his father is a Dominionist who believe that Jesus Christ is the head of state? I mean, they're essentially theocrats. They're, you know, like the Iranian regime or the Taliban, which obviously they don't like those comparisons, but they think they're inescapable.
Well, I avoid the comparison myself. They are certainly theocrats, but of a distinctly American variety. And evangelical Christian variety, and that's no small thing. One of the things that's so interesting to me about Ted Cruz is that he was raised to be exactly the kind of man and politician that he is, and he's been called by his family and by religious leaders around him an anointed one and, you know, potential king in the Old Testament sense of the word, and. I think that's a really important part of his identity. It's not just a casual set of religious doctrines. It's not a conversion experience. It's a detailed development to be a religious political leader of exactly the sort that he's become. And, you know, not your average Catholic or Episcopalian or Jew here. He is raised to be this particular kind of evangelical theocrat, and we've never seen anything like him.
So how do you explain, though, that he's a supposedly an avid constitutionalist and knows the Constitution inside out? There is such a thing as separation of church and state, and in spite of all of the propaganda from the religious right about how our founding fathers were are all Christians, they were actually quite skeptical about the abuses of Christianity that were going on in Europe. And went out of their ways to separate church from state.
Well, I agree with your understanding of history and the Constitution, Ian. But Cruz and his followers and many others on the Christian right don't agree with us, and they would say that the founders were primarily Christian, thought they have a specific Christian culture and constitutional ethos, and that separation of church and state was not the intention. The idea was to keep religion out of government, or rather government out of religion, and that a particular kind of religious freedom, one tilted heavily towards Christianity, was actually the intention. And what's happened since those halcyon days is a drifting away from the original intentions and God's intentions for this country. So that's a fevered vision that one could argue is a interpretation of convenience of the Constitution and sort of the intentions of the framers. But to them, church and state is a dangerous myth.
So then let's turn to Ted Cruz's penchant for lying. How that's not particularly Christian.
Not particularly good for any politician who gets caught at it as often as he does. I think that's a problem for him.
But what informs it, do you think? Does he have some sense that from Dominionism or whatever Christian zeal informs him that it's okay? Is it some kind of notion like Plato's noble lie? I mean, what is it, do you think?
Well, in his case, it could be one of two things. If he's serious in the biblical sense about approach to being in a religious war, the war of God against satanic forces of secularism, if you will. A lot of Dominionists look to the biblical story of Rahab, which was a woman inside the walls of Jericho who was an Israeli spy. And she was she hid a couple of Israeli agents and lied to protect them from the police. Now, that kind of lie was considered righteous and justified because it was in a time of war for a good cause, for God's cause. So the idea of doing that is fully justified in that kind of biblical sense. So is he justifying his political lies in that way? My guess is probably not. I think he's just a cynical politician who thinks he can get away with unethical practices. And I think that that's part of his problem in not moving evangelicals in the way that one might expect.
So it's not Plato's noble lie then in this patronizing sense that the public are a bunch of sheep and you just have to lie to them to get a greater cause achieved.
Well, like I say, that's possible. Keeping in mind that that Cruz is a highly educated man. He went to Princeton and Harvard Law, so he would have been familiar with the idea. Whether that's specifically what's involved here, my guess is not. That the idea of Rahab the harlot would be more likely as his philosophical justification for political lying, but I think. But I think that's just being too generous. I think that he's just a particularly unethical politician.
Well, Frederick Clarkson, I'm afraid we've run out of time. We're going to have to revisit you because I want to talk further about the when exemption is the rule, the religious freedom strategy of the Christian right. That's something that we're going to obviously is going to be around for some time, particularly with this hung jury on the Supreme Court. It'd be very interesting to explore that again. I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Anytime, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. His books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And he has a new report at politicalresearch.org, When Exemption is the Rule, The Religious Freedom Strategy of the Christian Right. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.